I don't know anyone who has more memories of Elvis than our guest Jerry Schilling, who has been involved in so many Elvis film documentary projects over the years. He has managed the Beach Boys, Jerry Lee Lewis, Lisa Marie Presley, and he got to know Elvis early on. And Jerry, it's great to be with you this morning. It's Elvis week, and I know you're busy in Memphis. Let's talk first about how you first encountered the King. It was really a touch football game, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the day after the night that his record was first time ever played on the radio. And it's a station I've been listening to since I was 10 years old. And they played the record, and then they played it. People called in, and they played it, you know, maybe three or four times more. The next day, I go to the park, and there's like five older guys trying to get up a football game. And one of them, Jerry, you want to play with us? And I said, yeah. You know, the 12-year-old kid always wants to be able to play with the big guys. And went back to the huddle, and I realized my quarterback was the boy from Humes High, Elvis Presley. And that started a friendship. We played every Sunday, and then, you know, he bought Graceland in 57 and go up to the parties at night, the all-night movies, when he would rent the Memphian Theater for all-night movies, amusement park. And, you know, I was still in school. I couldn't go to work for him. I was in high school, you know, and then my senior year in college. Just had all these plans to do. I was going to be a history teacher and a football coach, and Elvis said, I need you to come to work for me. And that was 1964. So met him, became friends in 54, and went to work for him in 64.
And it all started, as you said, with that record, That's All Right, played on, yep, on Memphis radio. That's all in the book. It's a wonderful book that Jerry Schilling wrote, Me and a Guy Named Elvis. Talk a little bit, Jerry, about the Elvis Presley you knew. Stories of his generosity and love for his fans are legendary. Was he like that because he grew up so poor in Tupelo?
I think that had a big influence on him. I know it did. And he wanted everybody to share his fortunes. And I live in a home in L.A. that Elvis bought me in 1974. So I've been there a little over 50 years. I lived at Graceland for 10 years. So Elvis has been a great landlord, besides being a great friend to me over the years. But, you know, growing up in Tupelo, they used to have car shows, you know, people back in the 50s, and go to the showroom and see what the new cars look like. Most of the people that did that couldn't afford to buy one, but they just wanted to see them. One night we're driving down the street here in Memphis here. There was a black couple with a little boy, and they were looking in the showroom window. And Elvis said, go back. And he went up to the lady and said, what's your favorite color? And, you know, they didn't know who he was. I forgot what she told him. It might have been blue. And he went in and bought the car for her, and we left. And he said, it reminded me when my mother and dad and I used to go and look in the windows of the new cars. So, yeah, it had a big influence on it.
As we mentioned, Jerry Schilling worked in various capacities with Elvis over the years. The stories late in his life, Jerry, about temper tantrums, not showing up for recording sessions, was that all because of drugs?
The last couple of years, he had a lot of physical problems. And he was taking prescribed medication for it. And, you know, I'm not a doctor. You know, people say, why didn't people help or whatever? In 75, we were in Vegas. I talked him into coming back to Memphis and stayed in the hospital for about 3 weeks. And he just had all kinds of colon problems. He had so many problems. And we did what we could. It's just unfortunate to lose my friend in the world, to lose Elvis Presley at such a young age.
Yeah, 42 years old. It's hard to believe. It's been so long now. 1977, and tomorrow, Saturday, the anniversary of his death. Jerry Schilling in Memphis for Elvis Week, always this time of year. You had a falling out with him at one point, didn't you, Jerry?
Oh, two or three points. But I'm I'm very proud of that because I think when you live with somebody, work for somebody, you know, party with them, all that stuff, if you, over a 23-year period, if you didn't have an argument, boy, you should have married that person or something. I don't know. But, yeah, you know, it made the relationship. I mean, at the moment, it was, you know, traumatic. But when we look back, you know, it was an honest relationship, you know. Not every day, but if I felt strongly about something and he felt strongly about something, and this only happened three times in 23 years.
That's pretty good.
You know, we could have an argument, you know, a pretty heated argument. And I just know I was the only guy he never fired. We might have had an argument or two, but I didn't want to be, nor I don't think he wanted me to be, a yes man. You know, we kind of have that image of, you know, Elvis laughed and we laughed and all that. That wasn't true, and I'm not the only one to. I mean, you know, there were some pretty strong people that worked with Elvis, you know, and you had to be because he was a strong guy, and he, you know, but we were a band of brothers, and yeah, it's all in the book, right?
The Memphis Mafia is part of it, that's for sure. Me and a guy named Elvis, the book. Yeah, and you were the guy with Elvis and President Nixon, weren't you? You kind of helped make that happen,
was the time,
right?
When I wasn't working for him.
Uh-huh.
I was working in film editing at Paramount and got a call in the middle of the night. And I said, "Who is this?" And he said, "It's me." And I said, "Elvis?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Can you pick me up at the airport?" Talking about the Los Angeles airport. He was flying from Memphis to Washington, Dallas, and then to L.A. So I said, "Yeah, I can pick you up. Who's with you?" And he said, "Nobody. And I don't want anybody in the world to know where I am." So I went, "Okay." And, you know, I picked him up. I guess the flight got in at 1 a.m. in the morning. And I asked him if I could use a driver that he, you know, used because he didn't want anybody to know, you know, where he was. So I was able to use Sir Gerald, our driver, and picked him up. And, God, I never will forget that. He's walking off the plane. He's got this little box that they used to give you on long flights that have a toothpaste and a washcloth and a little cardboard box. I said, "Elvis, what's that?" And he said, "It's my luggage." I mean, he had never traveled by himself before. And, you know, he was giving me all the flight. I said, "You know, where are you coming in?" He was giving me all the flight numbers and whatever. So we get to a house in L.A. in Beverly Hills that he was selling, and it hadn't been sold yet, but there wasn't much furniture or whatever. And he said, "Why don't we get some sleep and we'll talk tomorrow?" Well, I realized that I was the only person in the world that knew where Elvis Presley was. So I wasn't going to go to sleep. I called my wife and said, "You know, hey, I'm staying here with Elvis. I won't be back home." And then the next day, you know, we got up and just kind of caught up. We hadn't seen each other in about 2 or 3 months. And had a nice conversation toward the end of the day. He said, "I need you to go to Washington with me." And I said, "I can't." I said, "You know, I'll lose my job at Paramount. It took me a long time to get this job." And he had problems flying out because, you won't believe this today, but, you know, he had 3 guns on him. And he had permits for all of them. And a male steward said he couldn't bring him on board. And Elvis got upset, left the plane. The pilot came running after Elvis. "It's okay, Mr. Presley. You can bring your guns on board." So I'm thinking, can I let him fly, you know, by himself again? He almost got in trouble coming out. So I made a deal with him. If I could call Graceland, talk to Vernon and Priscilla, let him know, let them know that he wasn't kidnapped or whatever. I was with him. And if I could have one of the security guys, Sonny West or Red West, meet us up there, then I could fly back. And, you know, he said, okay, that makes sense. And on the plane, on the way, he had talked to his Senator Murphy from California, and he came back. Senator was in coach, and Elvis came back to first class. He said, "Do you think they have stationery on the plane?" So we got American Airlines stationery, and that's when he wrote the president a letter, and President Nixon, and he said, "You can contact my personal public relations, Jerry Schilling, and we're at the Washington Hotel." And, you know, I got a call from Bud Eagle Crow, who was on the White House staff, and he didn't know if other people on the White House staff were pulling a prank on him, because they did that from time to time. So he called. He said, I'm calling for Mr. Schilling." And I said, "Speaking." And he said, "Are you with Elvis Presley?" And I said, "Yeah." "He's out at a meeting now." He was meeting with a guy named John Finlayer, who was head of the DEA, or, dangerous drugs and whatever. So he said, "Well, the president has read Mr. Presley's letter." We dropped it off on the way to the hotel at the Westgate, and would like to meet him in 30 minutes. So I called Elvis. Being the kind of friend he was, he said, "Okay, meet me. We'll swing by and pick you up, because we got a driver in Washington, D.C. Stand in front of the hotel." So I was waiting. I saw the car coming. Then I saw Sonny getting out of a cab. I said, "Sonny, leave your luggage with the bellman. We're on the way to the White House." And we wound up in the White House with President Nixon.
Only Elvis could make that happen, right?
Only Elvis. And, you know, he wanted a federal badge. It's called the DEA now. And the head of it, at the time, it was called Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, would not give him. He'd give him an honorary. Elvis didn't want any honorary. And the reason he wanted it is he was preparing to tour overseas, which he really wanted to do. And, you know, we had, you know, a few death threats, and he wanted to be able to carry a gun. And with this badge, he could. So Finlayer turned him down. We get to the Oval Room, and first of all, they brief us, "Why do you want to meet the president?" And Elvis was great. He said everything right. Then we all get up to go, and they said, "No, I'm sorry, only Elvis can go. It's a Secret Service thing." And, we're sitting there, and we say, Elvis is pretty hard to say no to. Phone rings. The president wants to see Mr. Presley's friends. So we go in pretty much right after he went in, Sonny and I. And Elvis talked President Nixon into getting John Finlayer to come over to the Oval Room and with the badge.
For you and Sonny West.
Elvis didn't want to leave until he got the official credentials. So we went down to the White House mess hall, had lunch, got the credentials, and, that was made history.
Yeah, I have that picture It was available from the archives with President Nixon and Elvis in the cape shaking hands. That was quite something. Before we let you go, Jerry Schilling, I know you were very close to Colonel Tom Parker. So much has been written about him, depicted in films. And George Klein used to say, Colonel Parker was really great for Elvis in the beginning, but not so much at the end of his career. What was the real story there, Jerry?
Well, I think Colonel was brilliant with Elvis's career in the beginning. I had the tendency to think that he wasn't as creative as Elvis needed him in the end. Until I read the current book by Peter Gorelnik. As much as I spent time with Colonel, you know, driving into Palm Springs and staying at his house and, you know, working in his office one day a week as a loan out from Elvis, when you read this book, half of the book is, you know, the story by Peter Gorelnik, who knew the Colonel, and is backed up. And the second half is the Colonel's letters, whether it was to the great producers like Hal Wallace or to the studios or to the record company or to Elvis or to Vernon. The letters are brilliant, and I was surprised. I mean, you know, I figured the formulas for the movies at the end that Elvis was tired of making, I figured Colonel was, you know, responsible for putting them in motion. Mm-hmm. I never discussed it with him. That was Elvis and the Colonel always discussed their business in private. But when you read these letters and Colonel writes to Hal Wallace, you know, Elvis is like a James Dean. He doesn't want to keep doing the same pictures. And I mean, that letter is what got Elvis King Creole his best picture. I was really and hit the letters. They were so brilliant for a guy who I think had like a fifth grade education in Holland. It's the most fascinating story. Colonel could be a bully. Colonel could be, he could be difficult. But if he liked you, he became your friend. And he was not a dishonest guy at all. He would never steal a penny from anybody. And anybody that knows him will tell you that. He was fun to be around. At the same time, you never knew, and he always kept everybody off balance. But there is no doubt that he was devoted to Elvis. I read one of the letters. It was a telegram. And I knew Elvis's father very well, too. And people would say, yeah, Colonel's like a father to Elvis. And he'd say, wow. That's not cool. Elvis has got a father, you know? That's what I would think. And then I saw this telegram from Elvis to the Colonel thanking him for all the stuff he was doing for him. And at the end, he says, I love you like a father. I mean, so if you really want to understand, I mean, the Colonel, this book has it all there.
Peter Gorelnik, a great Elvis biographer, he's written Last Train to Memphis and Careless Love, and now the new book is The Colonel and the King. Peter Gorelnik, yeah, he is great. And next to him,
he wrote the intro to my book, Bob, me and a guy named Elvis. Peter wrote the intro to that.
Yeah, other than Peter, I think Jerry Schilling is the guy who is the source for all things Elvis. Appreciate you talking to us from Memphis, Jerry. And one more thing. Normally in this segment, we do restaurant reviews and news. So, for the record, did Elvis really like peanut butter and banana sandwiches?
Yes. He really did. There's no doubt about it. And he... I was kind of saying, are you eating that again? He said, you should try it. And we're in the kitchen at Graceland here, and they were really good. I didn't keep eating them because I think you put on about 5 pounds every time you ate one. But
yeah, I bet.
Yep, he really did.
Jerry Schilling, appreciate you talking with us, and always appreciate your work on all of the Elvis projects over the years. We continue to follow your career. And again, the book is Me and a Guy Named Elvis, Jerry Schilling. Thank you very much, Jerry.
Thank you, Bob, and thanks for, you know, all you do for the legacy of my friend, okay?
All the best. Take care. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.